Hello, welcome to the third episode of Dots of Thought, DOT, as I like to call it. For this episode, I have decided I was just going to just wing it, you know. Before I go into some of the thoughts that I'm going to be exploring, let me say one thing. In the spirit of trying to still figure out, you know, what form this is going to take, I tried in the last episode to write down my thoughts as a way of seeing if it will work if I articulate my thoughts first and then before I bring it to the show. And while I liked how that played out, I felt that it's not like me really. The essence of, you know, this show, this particular show, is to try as much as possible to keep things fresh and spontaneous, like I always like to say. And Dots of Thought is basically what it is, dots here and there. But I also know myself. I know that, like, I'm very disjointed in my way of being or my way of thinking. And in fact, I've written about this several times in my poems. Or will I even say that it's a constant reoccurring theme in my poems about my disjointed way of thinking, about this whole notion of being stretched across or spread across borders and places. And it's as if that I'm at every point in time, I'm trying to make all these correlations in no given order, as a way of bringing those parts together, those parts of me together. But in a podcast like this, I was saying to myself, okay, you have to find a way to, you know, make this coherent and make, you know, things more articulate. So that's the point of having a podcast, right? But man, I'm saying, okay, that's not me. I'm just going to try and wing this and hopefully it works. I hope it works. So I've been doing a lot of reading as well as a lot of thinking. You know, I've been reading books that I didn't have time to read. So in this period of lockdown, I've had time to sort of like explore some of those books. And one of them is this beautiful book. I won't say beautiful. I like to use the word beautiful a lot, even when it's completely out of place. But I would say a really commendable work that was done by Ntone Ejabe of Chimurenga in Cape Town, South Africa. And the book is called Festac 77. It's a compilation of this very eventful event that took place in Nigeria in 1977. Basically, the Second World Black and African Festival of Arts and Culture. And it took place in 1977 between Lagos and Kaduna. And so what Chimurenga, through Ntone, has done is to compile materials, found materials, publications, basically an in-depth research. And then they came up with this voluminous book that is titled Festac 77. And first of all, I love the form of the book. It is put together in such a way as to underscore the fact that it's basically a compilation, an archive. And it is very coherent. At the same time, it is made to look like it is a mumble jumble of materials, but it is not. When you go through the book from beginning to the end, then that's when you realize that there's been some structure to how things were put together. It's almost like this anti-book. So, Festac 77, for those who don't know it, I think you should just, you know, be proactive and go out there and Google it. Before Festac 77, there's been a festival like this in 1966. That one took place, I think, in Senegal. And then it was supposed to happen again 2 years later. But it didn't. Things got delayed until eventually happened in 77. It was an uphill battle to get the festival going. But what's interesting is that at the end of it all, it happened. It brought together about 16,000 participants from about 56 countries from different parts of the African continent and the diaspora. It was an enormous event. And in fact, people continue to reference that event. For instance, in my other podcast, where I had a conversation with Akinbola Akinbiyi, the Nigerian photographer, he referenced Festac 77 as the event that really opened his eyes and really introduced him to art and the possibilities of African art, such that after that, when he came back to Germany, he took on photography and took it really serious. I mean, he was doing photography already, but after that event, he thought, oh my goodness, I want to be, you know, in this trajectory. I want to be part of this narrative going forward. Fela Kuti, I don't know how many of you know out there know about Fela Kuti the musician. It was also in the first Act 77 or around that period that he really was radicalized. So what's interesting about 77, that first Act 77, is that when you go through the materials, the sense you get is that the intellectuals, the artists, the politicians of that time were very much preoccupied with neocolonialism as opposed to post-colonialism. Post-colonialism was a secondary, if not a distant concern. What they were more interested in was the rooting out of neocolonialism, of course, as proposed or as coined by Kwame Nkrumah, who talked about neocolonialism as the last stage of imperialism. So you see that all the conversation was about how do we deal with the African elites and the African elitism so that we can make way for a progressive Africa, for a progressive Pan-Africanism. Now, Pan-Africanism is another term that was very central to that time. So you realize that fast forward to today, much of what they were discussing was for today, was for posterity. And I am wondering how much of the conversations that happened at that time has been carried forward to today. The sense you get from, you know, going through the materials is that the artists, the intellectuals, the politicians were really engrossed and they really understood that urgency. All the intellectual ponderings and conversations were very tactile and realistic. It wasn't like conceptual only. You know, people were thinking and thinking through all the way to what is the next line of action after all of this thinking and after all of these conversations. Today, I feel like with all the conversations going on, we don't have that sense of urgency. And that thing about prioritizing our own reality with regards to the African continent or the African or the Black people. Let me just go all the way out and say that I think that one of our biggest problems as Africans, as Blacks, is simply misplaced priority. That's it. That at every point in time, we find ourselves being distracted by other issues, by other things, as opposed to thinking about what is good for us and what conversations should be having and how we can, you know, work for our own priorities. I think that's the only thing. It is not so much about what culture we choose to associate ourselves with, where we choose to live in the world or not. But I think it's just this thing about not getting our priorities right. And when you don't get your priorities right, then you are being pulled here and there by other conversations that has little or nothing to do with your own immediate reality. But anyway, in order to extend this conversation, I am going to call Donny and we are going to have a conversation about the book. He's currently in Cape Town and I'm here in Berlin. So I'm going to call him via a phone call and we are going to talk about some aspects of the book.
Bruce.
Hello.
Bruce, how you doing?
Final. How is it now?
We just the whole breathe in, breathe out. That time, it's all basic now.
Wow.
For real.
I tell you. But still, you are very busy. Nevertheless, so.
How we do now? So intellectual work, the carry.
So
just stop.
Yeah, I can imagine. So is it like that you get to move around in the city, or is it just?
No, it's total lockdown this side. It's total lockdown this side. Not if you leave home.
Wow.
Yes, we they fully confined. You know, if you go out without permission.
Wow.
From the military.
That one
it's
is intense.
Lagos in 1973.
Wow.
For real.
Wow.
Confinement. The army, they road now.
Wow.
We get roadblock and everything. No, it's for real this side.
So for how long now? What are they saying in terms of?
No, for a month. It's been a month now.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they will relax at the beginning of May, but mm-hmm. will not, you know. this is too good an opportunity for them to keep us in check. So they're not going to let it go easily.
Yeah.
How your side? How your side?
Yeah. Fine. No.
Family, they're fine? Yes. All good that side?
Yes, all is fine. Okay, all is fine. There are things
we give thanks.
Mm-hmm. Things are a bit relaxed here in Berlin. Huh?
Okay, yeah. Okay. No, it's better.
Yeah. People are still going out. You know, it's also at the same time sunny.
Ah, so, nice. So at least you get good vibration from the cosmos.
Exactly. So, but I mean, I have issues with that, you know, because, you know, anyway, that's for another story. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. No, we'll talk.
Exactly.
I love to hear.
Sure.
Hey, but before we go, also, you know, I just want to big up for the works you've been doing, man. I mean, taking it upon yourself to make some of these stories available to people who don't have access to them. So really, really much thanks for the support. But more than the support is the attention, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we do these works and then we put them in the public domain, you know,
mm-hmm.
our own obsessions and our own preoccupations, whether personal or collective.
Yeah.
And then from there on, you know, it's just for our people to pick up on them, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And when it catches one's eye or one's attention, so for me, I don't take the attention for granted, you know what I mean? To pick it up and say, okay, I want to follow up on this, you know?
Mm-hmm,
so we
mm-hmm.
give thanks.
Yeah. Man, I appreciate. But it's also because I'm looking around and I'm seeing all this beautiful work that has been done, you know, in our time.
Mm.
And because you know that for us, like I was just saying now before I called you, one of our biggest problem or challenges is, you know, having this misplaced priority.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that mm-hmm. we have so many things going on, so many conversations going on that's pulling us here and there that has very mm-hmm. little to do with our own reality on how we can, you know, sort of like deal with our own stuff. So
true.
When we see people like you actually saying, okay, look, before we talk about progress, let us go back and look at, you know, what is there. Before we say that it was not there, you know, it has not been done before.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So we can define progress for ourselves, not someone else does it for us.
Exactly.
You know? And you can only do that if you know how much road you've traveled.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know.
Otherwise, someone needs to tell you where you are.
Exactly. So, for example, now, this book that you've put together, this First Tax 77 that I've been spending time with, mm-hmm. you know, for the past like days now, going through, man, total education, huh? Total education. You know, and then, but again, not just, of course, we know that it happened. Huh? We get a sense of, you know, what took place then, but now we have access to writings, to essays, to interviews, you know? So when you read, for example, you know, the conversation between Lindsey Barrett and Prof. David Aradion, you know, talking about architecture, and the extensive work that he has already done. And then you now look at it in the light of David Ajayi, for example, right, today,
mm-hmm.
or Francis Carey,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
then you realize that mm-hmm. this conversation has been happening way before.
A long time.
So anyway, but before we go into all of that, Shah, let me ask you, you know, how did it even come to you to put together this book? And just let's talk about, you know, why you thought it was necessary to put together this book and some of the process involved.
You know, it wasn't, you know, even though we work through publishing, right, our aim is not to produce books. It sounds like a contradiction, but we don't want to, one of our works, one of our aims mm-hmm. at Chimurenga is to displace the hierarchy of knowledge that we've inherited from the West. So
mm-hmm.
in that hierarchy of knowledge, the book is at the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do all kinds of activity, and then all of that must be crowned by the book.
Mm-hmm.
I.e., this object, which is presumably stable mm-hmm. and historical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, much of our intellectual work, I don't mean ourselves, I mean even our forefathers,
yeah,
or at least for at least two centuries, has been to contest this particular arrangement, of how knowledge is produced and how knowledge is disseminated. For that matter, what knowledge is, So we know that the thing about Africans not having history is because presumably there were no traces of written material to articulate such history. Anyway, let me not go that far back, but I'm just saying that in terms of method, it was very clear to us that even though our part of our engagement will be through the production of books and writing and publishing, that will not be the core of our knowledge production method. We work through sound. We work through people, we work through space, we work through all kinds of things, right? So this project was about putting ourselves in contact with the history you just outlined. You find a few intuitions here, you hear a few things here, you hear something Fela said, you hear something Sandra said, you hear a few things here, there, and you say, okay, let me start going out of my way and meet some of these people and hear their version, because the one thing I know about this Festac thing that I knew at the time about this Festac thing is that nobody can talk about it, you know, for a few reasons. Either because it's unspeakable because it's too big for our current language, or because it was such a disgrace, so much corruption, all kinds of things, but no one will talk about it. So one aspect of our history gets to the place where it becomes unspeakable and unwritable. That's the aspect that interests me specifically. Those are the stories we want to tell. We want to tell the stories that are language, and I mean critical language, intellectual language, and all in all its forms, does not allow us to speak. Because we want our work to be the production of the grammar that allows those stories to exist in the public space. Festac is one of those stories. There's no coincidence that there had not been this kind of overview book on Festac. There has been one anthropological project put out by Andrew Apter, an American anthropologist, but it was more about corruption in Lagos and so forth. And and he was more talking about the military government at the time of Festac, but something that took into consideration the scope, the ambition, the utopia of Festac, but also people and everything in all aspects. You know, 30,000 artists from all over the world, based in Lagos for a month. Billions and billions of dollars spent. Infrastructure, all kinds, national theater, national stadium, you name it, the entire city being rebuilt for this. I mean, I'm like, how can something like that we go on as if it never happened?
As if it never happened. Like, and as a
have we done anything this big? I mean, since the pyramids? I mean, for me, this is civilizational scale. When you think about it, and I'm like, how is it possible that we go on as if it did not happen? So we just started organizing small events, reasonings of sorts, you know, to put ourselves in contact with the people who participated, who knew about it, gather some material. There was no book in mind. And we did this in Lagos, we did this in Brazil. We did all kinds of places, meeting these people, collecting their stories, broadcasting them. And then after doing that for a few years, we started doing this in 2014. After doing this for a few years, what carry on with other works, I became aware that actually part of the reason this story does not exist in book form is because it's unwritable. The story itself refused the form of writing, or at least the kind of computing that happens when you write. The way that you use knowledge to a particular code and system in order for readable by other people who did not experience that. Festac completely negates that option. So we somehow we took it upon ourselves as creative work to produce a form of writing. You know what I'm saying? That can accommodate the scale of this story.
I was just saying before I called you that, you know, what I like about the book is that it is like almost an anti-book.
That's it.
Yeah.
My brother, you're making me so happy.
Yeah. you know, and
you're making me so happy.
Yeah, and that's what's so that makes it so accessible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you see an essay Wole Soyinka about, you know, calling for a common language that is Swahili, and then mm-hmm. in the next page you see another play written by Ken Sarawiwa as a response mm-hmm. to that, side by side.
My brother. You know,
and
that's
then you realize that's you get a sense of the kind of like the how, you know, the conversion was happening and the urgency. Yeah. And for me, this is something you know that I really wanted to discuss with you. Is like I felt that for the intellectuals, for the artists, for the politicians at the time, you know, what was more important was to root out neocolonialism.
Mm-hmm.
More than post-colonialism. That was uh-huh. more like a distant, you know, conversation uh-huh. for them, or a distant concern.
Uh-huh.
They wanted to sort uh-huh. of, it's almost like to purge themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that Africa can really move forward,
uh-huh.
you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And you see uh-huh. all the infighting, all the battles, all the boycottings and everything. But at the same time, but you get this sense that at the end of the day, the way it's been put together in the book, you say, okay, this is actually, you know, the making, the content of that unity
uh-huh.
that we are striving for.
We say phrases like unity and diversity, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. You need a materialization mm-hmm. of these projects, of these utopia.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is not just someone sitting in their bed and saying, I'm African. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You have to give those imagination, which are old, which are millennia old, you have to give them form.
Yeah.
You have to put it between covers and someone go through it and say, I get it now.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
at least I'm seeing it. I'm mm-hmm. experiencing it. That people are not sitting in a room agreeing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
They are speaking different languages. They are going about different ideological agenda and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But you still get a sense of community through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we say today to our young people, Pan-Africanism, they say, that thing is gone now. Mm-hmm. That was something that Duma and them were pushing.
Yeah.
You have to put it in a format that they can experience.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Not just read about.
Yeah, exactly. And
which
that is why
mm-hmm.
that is why I love the aspect of, you know, performing Pan-Africanism, performing it.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
which uh-huh. you now use someone like Miriam Makeba to
uh-huh.
to articulate uh-huh. there. So maybe, uh-huh. maybe you can just continue the thought from there. This whole notion of performing as something that is constantly, that is cyclic, that is constantly happening as opposed to something that is over.
Totally. But, you know, this thing about the book is also important because since that's the medium, that's the format, the interface through which, you know, we are making this knowledge public.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the book is important. In 1974, Toni Morrison published a book, for me, one of her most important book, which is very little known. It was called The Black Book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the project of The Black Book was twofold. On one end, she wanted to, of course, trying to capture the African-American experience over three centuries,
mm-hmm.
you know. Now, how do you capture something like that in a book?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So already at the essence of the project, she was aiming for an anti-book,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But now she wasn't working on a negative project. What mm-hmm. she was really aiming for was a black book.
Mm-hmm.
This is why she called it the black book. So mm-hmm. she tried to imagine if black people had to actually produce the technology that we call book,
mm-hmm.
what would it look like?
Yeah.
So it wasn't just about the content of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You also had to do with the form of
the
it.
The form of
as
it.
In how you experience this object.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, that project is one of the most influential ways. It shaped how we think about publishing. So she took music as the basis, you mm-hmm, know what I'm saying,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of the most sophisticated articulation of black culture. And she said that if that's the reference that we use as the mode of putting ourselves into the world, then all of our intellectual production should aim to at least approximate that reference.
Mm-hmm.
So she tried to produce a book that will in fact sound like music. And the thing about music is that there, in music, all of those things that we struggle with in writing, for those of us who work with words, things like plurality, things like multidirectionality, things like polyphony, several voices speaking at the same time, polyrhythm, several rhythms going. That shit we do naturally in music.
Mm-hmm.
But writing, and it's linear,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
you know, approach, doesn't allow this because you start the story, you will lose me. If you start the money and then you are not, and then you back money, no feed.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you have to, we then she gave us the task to invent this. And one of the things that she did is that, okay, first, this kind of book cannot be altered. First, mm-hmm. you have to displace the author. You know, if you have one person sitting down writing their thing and say, that's that book. No.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, in the way that you work with music, you have to actually gather voices.
Mm-hmm.
You have to gather things and then put them in relation with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, this is a book that we wrote.
Mm-hmm.
This is not material we simply compiled in the form of a book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For us, we were experiencing with new forms of writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
New forms of writing that can capture the complexity, the scale, the epic scale
mm-hmm.
of an event like Festac.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to produce new forms of writing mm-hmm. to be able to tell a story as grand.
Yeah.
And not to tell
without
it
being dry. Without it being dry.
And allow opacity, allow things that cannot be understood,
mm-hmm.
allow people to speak different languages,
mm-hmm.
allow all of those things
mm-hmm.
become really important. So the experiment was not so much to write a book about Festac.
Mm-hmm.
The experiment was to write a book through Festac.
Yeah, yeah.
Through
yeah.
Festac. Mm-hmm. Use the unique experience of Festac, you know what I'm saying, as mm-hmm. motivation
mm-hmm.
to produce something like that.
Yeah.
But in terms of content per se, my main preoccupation was not so much tell the story of the event. My main preoccupation was to show how the event has impacted in our life so profoundly, and we do not even know it.
Exactly.
How it impacted on cultural policy in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
it made the arrival of someone like Lula possible,
mm-hmm.
how it impacted on the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. You know, Festac was the first time
mm-hmm.
that the liberation movement in South Africa came together because Mutala, when he was still alive, insisted that he did not want an ANC representation.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted a South African representation.
Mm-hmm.
So the ANC, the PAC, the SSRC, all of the disparate movements who were fighting each other had to come together
yeah.
to be able to produce. And that was the first time they had come together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that changed the trajectory of the South African struggle. How it impacted the struggle in Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
How it, you know, so those are the things, how it impacted this discourse, which is now coming back in Europe about the return
mm-hmm.
of African artifacts in the museum.
Yeah.
I wanted to show, no, this thing has been, for us, it's been a story
mm-hmm. we've
been infested. The Nigerian government used Festac as a platform to
yeah.
make that story public by
yeah.
demanding the mask of Queen Idia back.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to, it was pretty much a propaganda move to make that story public. So these kind of aspects that we are dealing with today that actually emanate from the fact that 30,000 radical Black people came together in Lagos at some point and then fought each other for a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that produces, you know, world-changing event, and we have to find ways to tell them.
Mm-hmm. You know? And you know, the book opened up with this survey by the Department mm-hmm. of Mass Communication of University mm-hmm. of Lagos in Nigeria about
mm-hmm.
close to 100 questions, you know,
right.
put out there. And they were trying
right.
to get a sense of how, you know, the Festac event
right.
has been received. Now
mm-hmm.
I find that very interesting because now I'm beginning to think what was the outcome of all the survey? And let's just, you know, set up a hypothesis where we all have that answers come together now. How do you think it's been carried over, you know, after 40 something years
actually,
to now?
I spoke to one of the people who wrote that survey,
mm-hmm.
who is an amazing Swedish intellectual, one of the first persons to produce video art, is still alive. He's in his 80s now. I spoke to the man. We spoke about this survey, and we even considered the possibility of making the survey public and sharing it among our people today. Because I was saying to him, I find those questions still relevant today. Because when I hear the things that people are seeing in the contemporary art world, I'm like, ah, they're still dealing with these things.
They're
still dealing with these very questions. So how about we make them public? And so it was important for us to say, in using that survey to open the book as the main text, was to say, no, this is a book about what we are going through. This is not a book about an historical event that happened in 1977. This is about questions we have not been able to resolve.
But I think it is really, really powerful how you opened up with that, because these are questions, you know, and it's not like you have to immediately follow it with all the answers, but it's a way of opening it. And also it actually allowed me to think, to imagine what the answers, you know, and the answer now could actually be broader than, you know, what the survey could actually give, which is basically the answer of the imagination. Of the younger generation today who do not have benefit of hindsight. How are they dealing with that gap?
We are in a situation now that everything is moving to the internet. We never decided this. You know, it's an institutional move to shift everything digitally, so on and so forth. Let me not go into detail about that. I have my own critique of what's going on. But that survey relates to that, because it relates to space, it relates to how you communicate your work, it relates to the ideal space you imagine for your work to reach people. Which people? Your people in the village, your people in the city, which people?
Yeah. Like
all of the questions that we are dealing with today as producers, are contained in that survey.
Exactly.
So it was important to show that.
I mean, like, it was so detailed. Like, it would ask questions like, you know, how was this particular medium received in radio, on TV, and, you know, different. And I found it very, very interesting. And, of course, I'm just like, all of this conversation is in the framework of, like you said, this everything moving to internet. And also this first time syndrome that we always have, which is, you know, I've called it elsewhere the Christopher Columbus syndrome, where
we keep rediscovering a bit.
Exactly. So I think that this is where this book comes in really powerful. This is, you know, I think so. But this is a conversation that I would love to have with you, you know, in a much, you know, broader context, maybe in this other podcast that I have, which is called Nkata, where I'm having like a long form conversation with art. I don't know if you know it.
Yeah. I heard Jihan, I heard Bona, you know, our people did there now.
Exactly. Good. So this is a platform to really like expand, because that one we can go up to 2 hours you know?
Okay.
So
no wala.
But this is really good. Thank you so much for
my brother.
Yeah, making this happen.
We are together.
Yes.
We are together. You just let me know. I'm ready.
Okay, no problems. No problem.
All right, sir.
So all take right. care.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye, yeah? Bye. All right, so that's Ntone Ejabe talking about the book. And, you know, it's all in the conversation. I am happy that what I was thinking already about the book resonates with him. Actually, I should say it that way around, that if I have picked up on what he is trying to achieve in the book, then it means that what he was going for has really worked. And I think it really worked, this whole notion of the anti-book. So that's it, basically, for today's Dots of Thoughts. Thank you very much for listening. If you like what you've listened to, please consider subscribing. Also, you know you can support the project by going to our page, our Patreon page, nkata.com/patron. There you see how you can contribute to the project, but most importantly, become one of the first or the founding or the foundational supporters of the project. And I think this is key, because we're just beginning. You see, you've heard from Ntone, what he said about projects that we are making. These things, we make them because we believe they ought to be there. I also appreciate the fact that for him, that he recognizes, you know, the need to bring attention to these things. For me, oftentimes, I always say, well, just do it and leave it there, and whoever will see it will see it. But he has touched on the fact that it is important to appreciate the attention when it comes. Of course, you're not doing it for the attention, but when it comes, it is important not to take it for granted. So on that note, I appreciate you listening to this, and please help share it with people in your network so that we can keep the conversation going. And if you have any comment, or if you have anything you want to say about what you've listened to, please leave a comment in any other platform you've listened to the episode. Thank you very much, and see you in the next one. Bye-bye.